The nice thing is that we did it in a way that's totally consistent with us and our values. The students are at the same high test scores, the same grade point averages as always, but they're much more diverse. We have something like a third of our domestic class, maybe 30% of our domestic class, self-identifies as non-majority, and that's a major change for us.
Non-majority meaning?
We have something like 26 new students who self-identify as Asian, 44 as Black, 57 as Latino, and 27 as two or more races. Those are very big numbers for us historically.
If you're 30% non-white or multiracial, how does that compare to historical numbers?
We think that most of the diversity in our student body at the moment resides in the last two classes. We've seen that much of an uptick in the diversity of our students.
Usually, diversity is hard fought for every little tenth of a point. What happened in the last 2 years to really give it a bump?
Well, we've made it a conscious priority. We have joined with the Posse Foundation, so we have a group of students who are on a leadership scholarship, 10, in this case 11 students a year, come up from New Orleans, and those students are largely non-majority. We have made a conscious effort in all of our recruiting territories to reach out to minority students. We've also been cognizant that while economic diversity is not the same thing as racial diversity or ethnic diversity or geographic diversity, we'd best be serious about recognizing economic diversity and addressing financial need where we see it. So on every front, we've been purposeful on this. We've also looked on campus at what we could do in terms of hiring more diverse faculty and staff. And of course, a key part of this is inclusiveness. It's not just about attracting people. It's about building an inclusive community.
So how much has the economic diversity of the student body changed along with the racial diversity?
Well, slightly. I think that change in any one dimension is going to come relatively slowly. We have a model where, like most higher education institutions, there's a mix of students paying their own way, government or other assistance, loans, and grants that we make internally. And that's roughly constant. We try to pay a little bit more attention to people at the lowest end of the scale.
So less fast than the actual racial diversity?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Another thing that you've been emphasizing over this last 8-month period or so is the McLean County Scholarship. You wanted to draw more from the local area, and how did that turn out in the fall?
That turned out very well, and it's actually explicitly a reaction to a lot of the brain drain things we've been seeing. It's not just Chicago, it's not just Illinois, it's this community where we want to help people stay. We have a committed group of supporters of Illinois Wesleyan, the Illinois Wesleyan Associates. There are a few alums there, but it's mostly people in town who recognize the tight tie between Illinois Wesleyan and this community, and they've been great. We've raised something like $780,000 towards scholarships in less than a year of talking to people about this. And as a result, we've had something like a 35% increase in the number of students from McLean County who are coming in.
What is that in actual students?
39 this year, and we typically have about 25.
That is what you've been hoping for.
Yeah, and it's a marker, I think, of sort of what we can do if we get out there and actively talk to the people who we think would be good fits here.
If you've had this much of a jump in the first year of the McLean County Scholars Program, where do you eventually want to end up? What's the top end for that?
Oh, that's a good question, Charlie. I'm not sure we've envisioned what the top end would be. We'd like to have about $500,000 per year for each class year in scholarship support. And I suppose that if you work through the numbers, that's probably about 20 of the scholarships that we're offering. So there's undoubtedly a ceiling on it, but I think that we've got room. If there's anybody who's listening to this and contemplating it, please do contact us about next year. We're also working hard on transfer students. We have increased by 50% the incoming number of transfer students, and part of that is a conversation with Heartland about how we can better ease the passage of students, especially those who get the AA at Heartland and then are interested in Illinois Wesleyan. So we're in the process of working out some of the details. We pride ourselves on sort of a four-year experience that begins with interesting collaborative seminar kinds of experiences for our first-year students, including what we're calling the first-year experience, and culminates in these signature experiences for seniors. And so we're trying to find the path that best incorporates people who come partway through that.
All of these efforts have resulted in the largest incoming class in at least 5 years. What is that actual number, and what is your actual enrollment?
The number that we typically talk about is a result of a census that we take at the end of the second week of class. Right now we think, hey, we have about 550 new students on campus. And what the actual number is that we end up quoting will depend on, there's probably a couple more people to come in, transfer students in particular, we can accommodate at a relatively late date like this. There'll probably be a couple of people who get homesick or otherwise leave. So we think that no matter what happens, that five-year claim will hold, whether exactly at 550 or a smaller number. We'll wait and see.
Obviously, you just graduated a quarter of your student body, or roughly a quarter. What does that do to overall enrollment, which had been trending downward over a fair number of years?
Yeah, it's the reversal of the trend that we wanted, and we have a plan in place for what we need to do in the out years. Right now, we have 1,700, and that's not a bad size for us to be. We've got room for more, and if we went to 1,800 or even potentially as high as 1,900 or 2,000, that would be good. The key, of course, is how you do that. It's got to be, you know, we're building a community. Every time we're letting students in, we're building a community. And so what we have to do is, whatever we think about regarding numbers or other sorts of questions regarding enrollment, first and foremost is, how do they fit in that community that makes the experience special?
So that roughly 500 kids this year, how much of a change is it from last year?
It's a significant increase, and I think that there are ups and downs in any given year, but that's an increase of well over 100 from last year.
So and if you can repeat those numbers over the next 3 years, you do hit your 2,000 goal.
We do. There's normally a little bit of attrition. We do exceptionally well at retaining students from year to year. We're among the very best in the nation at doing those kind of things. That's nice. It says good things about what it is that we're doing. But that means that we're going to lose probably 10% of our students, give or take, as they go from freshman to sophomore, and then smaller proportions. But you always lose a few along the way to whatever. We'll also pick up a few transfer students. So the math isn't as simple as we might like it to be. But yes, if we had classes as big as 550, you know, we're looking at something more than 1,900 and probably something a little less than 2,000.
If this year is a proof of concept, or yes, it's working what we're doing, and the next 3 years continue to work out, are there other forces shaping the marketplace and where kids go that will help or hinder you over that three-year period?
Well, I think that the higher ed marketplace is a funny marketplace. We tend to think about, we sometimes tend to hear about higher ed as if it were a single homogeneous thing. And, you know, I think that's couldn't be farther from the truth. You know, there are some for-profits that are often the villains in most stories. There are the flagship publics and the ones like Illinois State that are the jewels in the public crown. There are regional publics, there are high-end privates, there are sort of other private not-for-profit schools. And I think that part of the question for us is positioning ourselves. We need to be in the position that we're seen as the elite place that we are. And I think part of the reason that we're recruiting as well as we are now is because people see that, because prospective students and their parents understand that we're one of a very small number of places who can provide the kind of experience that we can, and so we're recruiting nationally. We have students from 38 states this year. That's a big number for us. We tend to be very Illinois-centric, or at least have been in the past. We got our first kid from New Hampshire in recorded history, as far as I understand. So, you know, this is part of sort of pushing ourselves out nationally. People had fewer kids beginning with the Great Recession, people who were displaced from jobs. And so the number of college-age students 18 years down the road, 2024, 2025, somewhere in there, we know is going to turn down. And a lot of what we're doing is positioning ourselves for what we know is coming. You know, demography is destiny. We know that this is coming down the pipeline. And so we need to be positioned, certainly by 2025, to be that place where people understand the specialness of what we do.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker, talking with Illinois Wesleyan University President Eric Jensen. You have some new majors that you put into place last spring. Are those proving popular?
Well, majors are you put in place and then you wait to see what happens. To me, the proof in the pudding is 4 years down the road, how many diplomas have that written on them? And I think that we're encouraged with the interest that we've seen in these majors. Biochemistry, health and fitness management, marketing, and neuroscience are all areas where there's clear interest and a clear niche for the graduates. And so I think we're very excited about these possibilities.
One way you're trying to encourage people to take a look at those majors and to show creativity apart from that is a new makerspace on campus. Tell us about that, would you?
Yeah, that is an accompaniment, although not solely an accompaniment to a major that came online last year, which is Design, Technology, and Entrepreneurship. And to do the sorts of things we want those students to do, they have to be able to make stuff. And so there's a 3D printer and a laser cutter and sewing machines and you know, various things that you can use to craft objects in a new space on campus. It's open, actually, to everybody on campus who'd like to use it.
So how does that differ from the traditional headspace of academic rigor? It's a physical kind of concept that you're trying to encourage, a physical intelligence, looking at spatial relationships through the operation of these devices. How does that affect the rest of scholarship?
Well, I don't think it's really that separable. I think that one of the things that we're really working on with everything from the first year experience, where, for example, animal studies scholars will spend time at a zoo working with animals, to the signature experience where students can meld the academic experiences they've had with other interests that they may have. And they may do a traditional academic research project with a faculty member, or they may do something that's got a much more sort of a diffuse set of outcomes associated with it than the traditional honors project. All those are designed to let people express problem-solving creativity and the kind of things that we think we're very strong at instilling in people in ways that are maybe ways that certainly weren't available technologically 10 years ago, but are now. I'm an economist by training, and at some level, when I'm working on a computer, I'm building something. I'm building, in my case, sort of a conceptual model, but it's a model that if the gears don't mesh, it's not going to work. And so when I think about it, almost as if I were a mechanic. I think about diagnosing problems with it in ways that, if there were a physical analog, would be interesting. And in the case of the makerspace, we're trying to get people to create not necessarily functional models with turning gears, but to be able to solve the problems that it takes to make something operate. And that's a lot of what we do in any of the intellectual undertakings that we're working with students on.
So how does thinking differ, even if you're thinking on a computer and using that as a tool to try to do, as you said, create an analog of thinking with your hands? How does thinking differ with your hands from the traditional conceptual thinking that happens in political theory or mathematics or something like that?
It's a little bit like I'm old. I'm old enough that when I first learned statistics, there was a little bit of hand calculation that was still done just to prove you knew how to do it. I learned nothing about statistics by having to do the calculation by hand. The machine, the computer, actually helped me learn statistics better than I could have had I sat there with a pad and a piece of paper. And I think that a 3D printer, for example, is much the same way. There is no real handwork involved with a 3D printer. It's computer programming, and it's trying to understand how a fairly abstract thing, a computer algorithm, a set of machine language statements, turns into a physical thing. And I think that that is conceptual thinking of the highest order, and at the end of it, you've got proof. You've got a solid object that showed that you knew how to do it.
The common application is a single form that students can use to apply to more than 800 colleges and universities. It will no longer include the question about criminal histories beginning next year, which brings up the question, how does Illinois Wesleyan University handle a question of previous criminal history, and what are the pros and cons of whatever you're doing?
Yeah, the Common App has flip-flopped a little bit on this. I think last year the announcement was they were taking the opposite course. We have typically, on our supplemental application, schools typically have a Common App and then a supplemental part that's unique to them. And we've typically asked for that. And so in our current application, I think that application was set some months ago, we ask about criminal background. And then the question, I think, is what we do with it when we have it. And we have never, I asked around about this earlier, we have never seen a report of it's about felonies, of felony being committed from any of our applicants. And so it's we can talk a little bit about the motivation. I think that we like to try to understand as much as we can about our students, and we like to think about the whole student when we're admitting them. And so one could potentially envision a circumstance where you'd like to know if a student has done something that might place other students in danger, and we would certainly like to know that. On the other hand, there may be crimes where students make mistakes. Maybe there's a situation where we might want to consider that. So I think we're in the position where we've never had to act on it, but we do collect the information.
And what sort of process would you go through if you ever did have a positive that needed to be considered more in depth?
I think that's something that we're going to keep under discussion as we think about what our form is going to look like next year. We'll move into discussion of what that form will contain sometime in the next few months, and as part of that, I think one of the things the Common App discussion has helped us do is understand that we'd like to have a fairly formal process in place so that we understand what our rationale for that would be and what we'll do with it.
Campuses always look just about the best they can when the new kids come to town. A whole summer has been spent spiffing things up. Building projects tend to come to fruition. Illinois Wesleyan has had a fairly sustained program of improvements going on. Where are you?
Well, we had a three-year, $10 million plan that was financed by a bond reissue. You reissue bonds in the same way you refinance your mortgage, and you free up cash in that way. And so we have had a concerted effort to do things that aren't always glamorous. We take care of roofs. We take care of heating, ventilating, and air conditioning units. But we also do some things that have a little bit of a wow factor to them. And my favorite this year is, as we've culminated this campaign, is Buck Memorial Library, which is a 100-plus-year-old building. Absolutely gorgeous. It's a bright, shiny, white building, recently tuck-pointed with a new roof, new windows, new walkways leading up to it. It's been painted and spiffed up on the inside, and it's a thing of beauty to behold. And you're right, this is the time of year we want to look our very best, and people on our campus have been knocking themselves out to make this campus look as good as it possibly can.
Illinois Wesleyan University has added an esports team. This will be the first year for it. How competitive are they going to be, and how are their accoutrements?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? How competitive they're going to be? There's a magazine, a gaming magazine that did college rankings. That's welcome to 2018, and we're in the top five nationally on the strength of an exceptional coach and exceptional recruiting success. We have built a new facility in the Hansen Center that includes sort of a practice area and then what's called the stadium, where the people who are actually competing are working. We have these absolutely spectacular chairs with the Illinois Wesleyan logo on them. I think they may start to show up in administrators' offices. Hopefully not mine. They'd be too easy to track down. They're very distinctive. But we've got some wonderful facilities in place, and we're looking forward to the first match.
Will they be televised? There are some eSport tournaments that are televised.
Yeah, apparently one of the really highly rated things on ESPN is eSports tournaments. We have the capability to cast the tournament to the big screen, which is about 20 feet, in Hansen Center and seat about 300 spectators. So we'll see how that goes.
Do you expect an audience?
Yes, it's very popular. And in fact, a number of people have come through to see that as part of their orientation or part of their campus tour. People are very excited about this.
So which is the bigger draw, the lacrosse team or the esports team for recruiting?
That's like asking a parent who their favorite child is. No, they're great. They're all great, Charlie.